coming up on the Psychedelic Therapy podcast.
And in our most recent trial, the latest findings are that the SSRI does, just as you described, blunts amygdala response to both emotional valences, happy and fearful, whereas the psilocybin, it does actually dip the activation to negative emotion, but it doesn't touch positive. You know, if anything, I think there might be a tiny increase, but not significant. So that's nice, makes sense. And people talk about SSRIs blunting, as you said, emotional responsiveness generally, and that's a side effect, that emotional blunting that people describe. But maybe the effect with psilocybin therapy is like a remediation of a pathological sensitivity to negative stimuli while keeping your ability to experience pleasure intact, you know?
Welcome to the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast, a weekly conversation series with leaders in psychedelic culture, designed for therapists, healers, retreat leaders, and passionate enthusiasts. Presented by Maya and hosted by me, Eamon Armstrong. Named one of Time magazine's most influential people of 2021, Robin Carhart-Harris conducts some of the most impactful psychedelic research in the world. Recently, he conducted the first head-to-head study of psilocybin and a major antidepressant. And on the show, we'll discuss that research, as well as Robin's illustrious and very impactful career. On the podcast, we review Robin's early research with MDMA and his involvement with the first fMRI and MEG studies of LSD. We talk about his 2016 study of psilocybin's efficacy with treatment-resistant depression and his most recent head-to-head comparison of a psychedelic with a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor. The outcome of that study calls into question a generation of psychiatric scales. Recently, the head of the Center for Psychedelic Research at Imperial College London, Robin Carhart-Harris, is now moving to the Neuroscape Psychedelic Division of UCSF. For 15 years, his research has focused on how drugs such as LSD, psilocybin, DMT, and MDMA work in the brain, and how they may be useful in treating disorders such as depression. Robin is also an advisor to Maya, the measurement-based care platform that makes this show possible. And now, here's Robin Carhart-Harris. Robin, welcome to the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. I have been a fan of your work for a long time, and as all of us in the psychedelic community have really gotten so much out of all of your work, what you've contributed, all the ways that you've shown up, it's really an honor to be here with you, and I'm so excited to talk to you today. So thanks for coming on the show.
Well, thanks for having me. Yeah, really happy to be with you.
You're moving over to UCSF, that's actually my corner of the woods. Why are you choosing to move over to California now, to this institution? Is there any sort of research that you're excited about doing there? What's bringing you over to this side of the pond?
Yeah. Well, Adam Ghazali had a lot to do with it. So I met Adam, who is the founder of Neuroscape at UCSF. Very pioneering and exciting, you might say, neurotech or translational neuroscience center, UCSF. And I met Adam through his friend and my friend, I'd like to be able to say, Tim Ferriss, and had a great chat. Adam came over to the UK with his wife and stayed with my wife and I in Oxford. And we had a lovely time and got to know them a bit. And yeah, we started to kind of lightly chat about possibilities in his neck of the world. And I was very tempted. And I guess things evolved and a very generous offer came my way as a career promotion to professor. And it was too good an opportunity to turn down. And I've always really enjoyed my time in the States. I feel very welcomed. The communities that I've been around, and not just the psychedelic one, but also so the psychiatric community have been very welcoming, very open-minded, very polite, actually. People talk about the Brits being polite, but I think you guys are even better. We can be a bit grumpy at times and very reserved, you know. So I like the kind of easy breezy American way. It suits the kind of more rigid British style, and I just enjoy it. And there's always, you know, rough with the smooth, but that's part of life. Other nice things, nice weather, very liberal and forward-thinking city and area. All of that stuff I embrace. There's something a bit special about the Bay Area. And I'll have to get used to earthquakes, I suppose.
we don't have them that often. You more have to get used to all the fog, but I guess you have that where you're from too.
Yeah. I also heard it's sunnier on the east side of the Bay, so we're probably going to have somewhere over on the east side. In fact, we are for the first few months, which is nice.
Well, it's interesting working with Adam. That really foreshadows the very end of this conversation when we might talk a little bit about digital phenotyping and depression. So a little foreshadowing potentially for our audience about better ways of tracking depression and outcomes to depression treatments. So I'm sure that he has a lot to say about that. But right now we are not interviewing him. We are interviewing you and your illustrious career. And you started, you were doing a master's in psychology that kind of got you into this whole psychedelics and psychedelic healing game. So tell me a little bit about your initial interest in exploring the human mind.
Yeah, well, put it this way, I think psychedelics had something to do with becoming interested in the mind and consciousness. And I'd actually failed at an earlier degree in biochemistry. I wanted to study neuroscience, and it turned out that neuroscience was a sort of bit part of this biochemistry with neuroscience degree. And I dropped out, and I was one of the lucky ones where I was able to fail. So privileged in that sense. And I ended up doing a degree in psychology in my hometown and Bournemouth on the south coast of the UK. And then after that, I enrolled to do a master's in psychology. And actually changed the master's program. I was down to do something more kind of run-of-the-mill in psychology, like applied psychology. And I went to the first couple of lectures, and it was boring. And I'm interested in psychology because I'm interested in the human condition and all its depth and intrigue and weirdness. And I noticed that they had another program in psychoanalysis. So I thought, oh, what a gamble, because it's not so scientific. This is my thinking then, and a little bit now still. But is it career suicide? In fact, you know, parallels with psychedelics there. But is it a gamble to do such a, you know, this is my thinking then, wishy-washy master's? But I asked if I could attend a couple of lectures, and they were absolutely fascinating. Totem and Taboo, Freud's Totem and Taboo was the topic of the first one. And I was just hooked, and I knew I had to do it. And so any advice for any young students out there, at least in my case, it worked out to follow my interests. And it really did work out in the end. And I got a lot from that master's. And during it, I discovered Stan Grof's book, because I was frustrated about dreams, bungled actions, and all of the indirect, unreliable ways that you get a clue that the unconscious mind exists. And I thought, there's got to be a better way. In a sense, there's got to be a drug. And first of all, I thought, oh, well, alcohol kind of makes you disinhibited. Maybe that's a window for unconscious to percolate up and affect behavior. And yeah, maybe in a way. But then I put in a search in the rudimentary internet at the time, and up pops Stan Grof's book. And I got it out of the library at the university, the campus university, and just devoured it. And I actually think I read, I don't know, maybe a day or two, no more. I just didn't put it down. Realms of the Human and Unconscious, remarkable book.
And yet your initial work in this space wasn't actually with classical psychedelics. It was with MDMA and research around MDMA's effect on serotonin, which also has a lot to do with depression. I mean, the hypothesis around depression for a long time, at least for laymen, was basically it was an imbalance in serotonin in the brain that could then be corrected by a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor. And we'll get into what that means and why maybe that's not entirely the case. But your PhD research was actually in MDMA's effect on serotonin. Can you tell me a little bit about that and what you discovered?
Yeah. So that was my way in, if you want. I went knocking on David Nutt's door in Bristol. He's heading up at that time the psychopharmacology unit at Bristol. And in parallel, knocking on Amanda Fielding's door, the founder of the Beckley Foundation. And I said, I want to do psychedelic research. I actually wanted to do brain imaging research with LSD, but this was the opportunity. MDMA was an easier way in. My PhD didn't involve the actual administration of MDMA, but it looked in MDMA users and it measured their sleep. And given that sleep is very much modulated by serotonin, sleep served as a proxy index, an indirect index of serotonin functioning. And so if sleep was abnormal, then serotonin functioning could be abnormal as a result of MDMA use, was the kind of rationale there. We also used a dietary manipulation which depletes your serotonin levels, tryptophan depletion, in order to kind of stress the serotonin system a bit to try and probe or accentuate any differences that might be there. And the short story from that PhD was that the MDMA users didn't have abnormal sleep, even when we stressed their serotonin systems with tryptophan depletion.
You were involved in the quite famous fMRI research in LSD at Imperial College London. And I was listening to a podcast actually with David Nutt in preparation for this. And something that popped up in that podcast that I found really interesting, particularly as someone who was really excited about those studies at that time, was the difference between an fMRI study and what it can tell you about LSD's effect on the brain versus an MEG study, which you later went on to do that research at Cardiff. And it seems like now there's a consensus around default mode network, a consensus that psychedelics are broadly working in a similar way on the brain. But you were one of the people who was part of bringing that research to the forefront. So I'd love to hear a bit about that and these two approaches you took to studying the brain.
Yeah, I mean, Cardiff today as well, they probably house the most impressive brain imaging center in the UK and on par probably only with MGH, well, at least UK, US, really amazing technology in Cardiff. And, you know, in the early 2010s, it was actually an earlier version of the imaging center called Kubrick. There's now Kubrick 2. And so they had fMRI, they had MEG, not that many sites have MEG. And so fMRI has that great advantage of being able to see deep into the brain. And MEG has the advantage of being able to record neural activity more directly and also to record it with very high temporal resolution. And it has a lot of sensors. So people might be used to seeing EEG, these kind of swimming caps with sensors here and there. And that might cover, I don't know, usually if you're lucky, 64 of sensors, you're more up into the like close to 300 sensors or even more with MEG. So it's a lot of these sensors. So you get better spatial resolution with MEG than EEG. So it's like super EEG. And there you're recording the brain waves, you know, is the sort of lay way to think about it. And if you put these two complementary modalities together, you're learning things with one that you were missing with the other. And I guess the short story is that the fMRI, in a sense, taught us about the default mode network. It said, yeah, this seems to be dropping in blood flow when you inject in psilocybin. So that seems to correlate with the intensity of the experience. And probably more informative, it's transpired now. This network and other networks break down. They start talking to other nodes in the network less, and other nodes or regions outside of the network, outside of their boundaries, more. So there's a disintegration and a desegregation in the brain. And that came out of our 2012 PNAS paper with psilocybin and was really consolidated in 2016 when we did something similar essentially with LSD. It's a really comprehensive paper, that one in 2016. And the MEG probably helped to really open the door to the entropic brain hypothesis with some solid empirical data that if you're recording spontaneous or ongoing brain activity not directed or constrained by any task constraints or instructions or behaviors, but just ongoing spontaneous natural brain activity, it becomes richer. It becomes more information rich under a psychedelic that correlates with the intensity of the experience. And that mapping is essentially an entropic brain hypothesis.
So I personally have suffered from depression. It runs in my family. I know a lot of people who have. The idea of the default mode network as being something that might provide some kind of an explanation for the recursive thought patterns that are endemic to depression makes a lot of sense for me. And it makes sense that psychedelics would interrupt that. And so I wanted to talk a bit about depression. And to start with, I just wanted to ask if you have had any experience in your life with depression, with yourself or with people that you love. Has depression touched your life personally?
Yeah, it has. I think personally, it touches so many of our lives. And while I haven't, you know, had a diagnosis of depressive disorder in my life and, you know, and gone into some kind of prescribed treatment for it, I did take myself to psychoanalysis in my early to mid 20s to kind of sort myself out, I felt. And so some degree of depression I've certainly known in my life. I think it informed my choices of academic career or direction, wanting to understand myself better, I think, with seemingly a lot of good things going on. Why do I feel low and other things? And probably psychoanalysis as well, as if there were like things to know, to be more conscious of, that I wasn't fully with the intuition that if I knew that stuff, it would be easier. And I think that's true. I think it does help to have a deeper, more comprehensive understanding, even if it's not like absolute and there remains uncertainties and so on, and you realize that self is a construct and all that kind of stuff. It's still a useful exercise. Some people, they're like, oh, it's all navel gazing, and certain people can have quite a downer on psychotherapy. Even say things like it's not without risks. There are side effects with psychotherapy, there is with drugs. Yeah, fair enough. But I think it's sorted my life out. Psychoanalytic psychotherapy put me on track when I felt like I should be on track. There was no reason not to be. And of course, life happens, adversity comes. But I think that, and since psychedelics have helped with the kind of flexibility and resilience, I've just been really lucky, I think, to be in a world with friends and colleagues who talk about mental health a lot. Yeah, it's just a topic of general kind of shooting the breeze sort of interest. I think that's really healthy. You can catch yourself when a depressive episode might be happening and then process it, know what to do with it, ride it out. So yeah, I've got to know it. And then I'm not a clinician, but I had the privilege of my involvement in the two depression trials that we've done at Imperial and witnessing firsthand the dramatic breakthroughs and improvements in other people's lives, and then seeing an intensity of depression that I haven't personally experienced but is so crippling and serious and dangerous, and then to see people's lives turn around through psychedelic therapy is deeply rewarding. So yeah, I've seen it from different vantages, I suppose.
Well, let's talk about these depression studies. In the first depression study, you had 20 individuals with the average of 17 years of treatment-resistant depression. So that's huge. And after a single dose of psilocybin, over half were in remission. Very, very impressive. And I'm sure for the people who were in that study and for the half who experienced that remission, an extraordinary relief. And so I'm just curious, what did you learn from that study, or what hypotheses did it forward in terms of how depression actually works in the brain and how psychedelics work to dislodge these kind of depressive patterns?
Yeah, I think the measured and modest thing to say is that it was a small trial and it was a start in a pretty seriously disabled population. We could get them back on track, a good proportion of them. And so it gave us confidence and it gave others confidence. And so the tolerability, it was a plus there. We can do this in such a vulnerable population. If you rewind to prior to our trial, the Hopkins trials and NYU and even Charlie Grove's work, we still didn't know, you know, in treatment-resistant depression, where suicidality typically is a high and a thing, can we even do this? And of course, we're so much further along now in quite a short space of time, but those kind of questions seem very valid back then. And so it was a confidence builder, really. We learned some other things, or got like intuitions, I suppose, about other things at the time, different patient types, and how, for example, patients with certain comorbidities, personality disorders, for example, are more complex and difficult to treat in a very, you know, stripped down treatment model that is just two sessions, only one at 25 milligrams that happens a week later, integration support that comprises of seeing them the next day and the next week, but not much else. So there was a sense of, for complex cases, this might not be enough, and a adaptation to the model might be justified in certain populations. So little intuitions like that. Also, a big sense I got is that TRD, and this kind of relates, TRD, treatment-resistant depression, is a tough cookie. And for some people, that's why look at something novel. But I wasn't convinced by this idea that SSRIs and in psychotherapies are cutting it, and that there is a met need presently in depression care by SSRIs and, say, CBT. And psilocybin therapy can only be looked at as a secondary treatment in those who failed the first-line treatments. And I didn't believe that so much that the next trial was going to be MDD, major depressive disorder, straight up general depression, still of moderate, at least moderate to severe severity. But critically, patients didn't have to meet criteria for treatment-resistant depression. And that meant that some of them could even have been having their first depressive episode, but it was severe and they could get into this new trial. As it happened, a lot of them did have still long histories of depression, long histories of a lot of different treatments. But so there was a sense of, oh, we can go up against SSRIs. Again, that confidence that came from that first trial really inspired the second trial, where it was a comparison with an SSRI.
What came out of that trial that was most interesting to me was this kind of look into the amygdala. Correct me if I'm wrong about this, but that the amygdala was something that we, in popular culture, we think of as the fear center of the brain, but it's actually an emotional center of the brain. And you found that the amygdala was actually more sensitive after a large dose of psilocybin. And then later on, it was less sensitive, but less sensitive to negative stimuli, whereas antidepressants seemed to blunt the amygdala altogether. And that was really interesting to me, because I think that as you're putting antidepressants and psychedelics head to head, one of the big complaints around antidepressants is that it kind of numbs everything. It numbs libido. There's all these different side effects. So this idea that right out the gate, the amygdala would actually be more sensitive is fascinating, and also lends itself to the importance of the psychotherapy alongside the psychedelic experience, rather than just take some mushrooms and you're going to be fine, but to actually have a psychedelic therapist there with you, supporting you. So I found that to be really fascinating.
Yeah, and it's not that anomalous. I remember presenting that work. In fact, my colleague Leo Roseman did at an event, and Chuck Rayson was there, and he jumped on it and he said, "Oh, this is really interesting. I've seen this with a meditation treatment, I think for depression, a similar kind of increase in amygdala sensitivity post-treatment. I think it was like a non-dual awareness style, or rather open awareness style. So it wasn't mindfulness, but, you know, a more kind of open awareness style of meditation treatment. I think it was that. It could have been compassion-based. But anyway, they saw that there. And so he said, this isn't so weird for me to see. And over time, and in our most recent trial, the latest findings are that the SSRI does, just as you described, blunts amygdala response to both emotional valences, happy and fearful. Whereas the psilocybin, it does actually dip the activation to negative emotion, but it doesn't touch positive. You know, if anything, I think there might be a tiny increase, but not significant. So that's nice, makes sense. And people talk about SSRIs blunting, as you said, emotional responsiveness generally, and that's a side effect, that emotional blunting that people describe. But maybe the effect with psilocybin therapy is like a remediation of a pathological sensitivity to negative stimuli while keeping your ability to experience pleasure intact, you know?
Well, and that certainly makes sense with the idea that adverse childhood experiences could potentially be part of depressive symptoms being expressed later, because that amygdala's hypersensitivity to threat, that all kind of makes sense to me. What's so great about psychedelic research is it just does such a great job of showing us what we experience psychedelics to be. It does seem like it opens up your view of life as bigger than yourself. It opens up perspective. And then that's explained a bit with this like reduction in activity in the default mode network, or the idea that there's an expression that you use for the way that your brain creates more connections in psilocybin.
Globally coherent brain state.
Yeah, well, it just bears out that would be what psychedelics do, because for those of us who've experienced them, that is what they do, but also that would be exactly what one might need when one's stuck in kind of the narrowness of a depressive episode, however long yeah. that has lasted.
Very much, and another update finding, a paper submitted to a really top journal is under review at the moment that is showing this effect. It can be described as modularity, where you might see an increase, a pathological increase in modularity and depression, where you might get stuck, just for the sake of understanding, stuck in a particular module, like a depressive module, and hard to exit that module and very easy to get sucked into it. And so what we see post psilocybin therapy, and we've looked at our data sets from both trials, is that the modularity decreases because the landscape is now more open. You can move around more freely. You're not stuck in like a literal depression in the landscape, like a hole. You can get out and you can move around. So a decrease in modularity. And the greater the decrease in that modularity in both data sets correlated with treatment improvements with the treatment. So really excited about that. I think probably more than anything, even the amygdala stuff, it helps to explain the therapeutic mechanisms with psychedelics. And just a little point on that, you know, the brain stuff is, I see it as like a, I don't know, it's like a side dish to the main dish. I mean, a lot of this stuff is psychology at base. And it's useful to know the neuroscience. It is useful. It enriches your understanding, puts a bit of biology on it, reminds you it's not magic. It's all nature. Even it can be magical in a sort of poetic sense, but it's of this universe. There's nothing supernatural about it. And I think it's nice. It's like, for me, it's like a deeper appreciation of nature is to understand the brain basis of these things.
I love that. And I love that it is magic, but in a poetic sense, not in a supernatural sense. I like how you phrase that. Well, let's move on to the most recent study. And this is the first ever study with psychedelics going head to head with an antidepressant. And this antidepressant is what we in the US call Lexapro. It is, how do you pronounce this word? Escitalopram?
Escitalopram. At least that's how I say it.
Escitalopram, which in the US we call Lexapro. And you did a research study comparing psilocybin and this antidepressant. And you got a kind of interesting result from that study in terms of how it was measured. And I think that that interesting result then opens up a deeper philosophical conversation. So I'd love for you to talk a bit about that study, the results that you got in terms of the clinical outcomes that you were specifically tracking. And I think that can lead us into a little bit of a philosophical conversation about tracking depression and health outcomes for depression. So tell me a bit about this study.
Sure. So let's start with the design, I think. So we're looking at people with major depressive disorder, depression for short. And there's two treatment groups or conditions that you can go into, and it's a double-blind randomized control trial. So it's effectively like a coin flip. We don't actually use a coin flip. We use a randomization algorithm. But it's random what group you go into, and you don't know, and the researchers don't know which group you've gone into. In group one, we'll call it the psilocybin group for simplicity. You get two treatment sessions guided with preparation, supervision with two guides for your session, and then integration support afterwards. You get two of those in a six-week treatment program. You get two of those 3 weeks apart, and you measure the depression ahead of any treatment and then 3 weeks after the second of the two doses. The doses are 25 milligrams. It's a big dose, mystical type experience dose, intentionally to try and engender these therapeutic breakthroughs, these big shifts in perspective. And alongside the two treatment sessions with psilocybin, people take inert placebo capsules every day. They don't know what's in them. They are led to think that there's a chance they could contain escitalopram, but they don't know that. They're actually contain microcellulose, which is inert. And they do that every day. They actually take one capsule for the first 3 weeks and two for the final 3 weeks. And we measure depression at the end. That's the psilocybin group. In the other corner, the other group, group two, people, instead of popping placebo capsules every day, they're actually taking escitalopram. They take 10 milligrams, one capsule for the first three weeks, and 20 milligrams, two capsules for the final 3 weeks. We also control for the fact that we have all the psychological prep and the dosing session with all the beautiful music and lovely guides, angelic guides that sit with you and then are there very supportively and compassionately for the integration support. We control for all that. You get all that in equal amount in the escitalopram condition. And we actually had everyone receive psilocybin. It's just in the escitalopram condition, you got a tiny dose, 1 milligram. Probably not active. If there is some activity, it's very, very attenuated. And so that's the design. I think it's a tough test for psilocybin because you're giving them a tiny bit of it. You've got all the therapeutic trappings and you're giving them a leading antidepressant first-line treatment for depression. Yeah, medication every day, not just twice, but 43 times, I think it is, if you work it out, 43 doses, not two, but 43 of this drug. And then you compare them at the end. And when we did that, I think most people are probably familiar with response and remission rates. They're the easiest thing to understand. And on the main outcome measure, response rates were at least 70%, or were they bang on 70%? There were no less than 70%, which is very high, in the psilocybin group. And is it just under 50% in the escitalopram group, which is typical for an SSRI. Remission rates were twice as high in the psilocybin group, up at 60%. So a little bit higher than what we saw in the first trial, probably because of the population. It was easier to get people with sort of general depression, not strict treatment-resistant depression, easier to get them into remission, meaning you don't have depression at that time. you're depression-free, 60% versus 30 in the escitalopram group. So again, very, very promising, and really pleased to put psilocybin against a tough comparator and see it come through like it did. I think if people to read the paper, they might get a bit confused because they might look at the mean changes and the miss on the primary outcome didn't quite reach statistical significance. But you have to look at the broader picture. Three of the four depression measures did, even on those average scores. And then the response and remission rates, you can kind of use intuition, look at them. And statistically, they came out in favor of psilocybin as well. And then you look at the ancillary or secondary outcomes, the additional outcome measures, stuff that really matters to people. Of course, dropping your depression scores does. But getting back to work, feeling socially connected, feeling really good, like well-being, feeling like you're flourishing. These significantly favored psilocybin, meaning psilocybin was significantly more effective at improving those more general domains than the escitalopram.
So something that was really surprising about this study, and tell me if I'm right in my understanding of this, that on a particular metric, there wasn't a clinically significant difference between the two. And that metric was this survey called the Quick Inventory of Depressive Symptomology Self-Report, QIDSSR16. And what was really interesting about that is this is a self-reporting survey. And this is Dr. Boris Heifetz says on Twitter, the inconclusive outcome may say more about a generation of psychiatric scores designed for SSRIs than it does about psychedelic potential. So this self-reporting survey came out with not as significant data as the other findings that kind of surrounded that. And I think that that kind of lends itself to how the question of like, how are we actually understanding depression? How are we tracking depression? How can we possibly track outcomes for interventions in depression if we're using an antiquated self-reporting scale for it?
Yeah, maybe the QIDS, in hindsight, I don't think is a great measure now. It was our primary outcome measure, and in hindsight, it was a mistake. You live and learn. It's actually not one of the older measures. It's a newer measure, and it was used in quite a famous trial, the STAR-D, and that kind of influenced me. It's a short measure. I like short measures. That had influenced why we had it as our primary outcome measure, and actually, it worked well in the first trial. Even so, those response and remission rates were based on the QIDS. So even if we focus on that particular tree, so to speak, then response and remission rates still look very good for psilocybin versus escitalopram at 70 versus 50 and 60 versus 30. But that point of calling it a tree is intentional because there are woods to see here. And that's kind of Boris's point, I think, to some extent. You choose a primary outcome ahead of a trial for good reasons, so you don't cherry pick afterwards. That's really why you do it, and you name a primary hypothesis. If people read the material, they see we actually had a primary hypothesis on well-being and significant improvements on that, but we didn't make it the primary outcome measure because it's less well-established, particularly when testing treatments in a depressed population, you would measure depression. So that was part of the maybe aspect of things that confused people a little bit. But again, he's right, you know, and Guy Goodwin and others have said something similar, that maybe for too long in psychiatry, we put all the focus on the negative domain. And what about improvements in functioning and positive affect, the ability to enjoy things in life and experience pleasure? They were very markedly improved by psilocybin versus the escitalopram. Another thing to say, though, is that point of, let's not get too distracted by a particular tree when there are woods to see. It's very relevant, though. These p-values are a kind of, they make things black and white when perhaps it's a bit contrived to do that. So another thing to say is that papers get edited. And so if you read that abstract and the narrative style of the paper, don't assume that it's my narrative, I would say, or the researcher's narrative. That is what it is. But the data is what I would say. People, if they're really interested in that trial, read the methods, pick it apart, look at the supplementary material, look at all the material, and look at the data. And in a sense, forget about the narrative and look at the data and form your own interpretation.
Oh, I love that. I think that's such a good invitation. We're so eager to have narratives that fit into our view of whether we're on the side of pro-psychedelics or whether we're on kind of an old school drug warrior side of things. We do want to fit things into our own narrative. And I really appreciate your invitation to really look at the data. Speaking of looking at the data, what data will we be looking at next? You know, you were mentioning that you'd chosen that particular scale. Are there other sorts of ways that you'd like to track depression and other mental health conditions as you move forward in your work?
There are. Recently, I wrote a paper, I think it was the next paper after the New England Journal of Medicine one, about pragmatic trials and digital data collection, real-world evidence. And I'm a big believer in that. And it requires a little bit of a pivot from maybe peers in a way who are often worship at the altar of the double-blind randomized control trial. I'm being a bit silly in saying it that way, but maybe we should question our assumptions about just how rigorous that design is and whether blinding, for example, is always upheld in these placebo versus SSRI studies, for example. Maybe it's not, and maybe, you know, expectancy and psychological factors are driving outcomes in favor of the SSRI to an extent that we don't realize. And if that's true, if there are flaws in the double-blind RCT, then we could, in a sense, say something else. And I actually think people have thought this way about interventions like ECT. If at the end of the day, the thing that we care and patients care about most is how they've responded and whether they're free of their depression, then you could just look at absolute response and remission rates. You know, what percentage of the people that you're treating no longer have depression? And if you frame it that way, you could almost make it a challenge for yourself and your team and say, we're going to try and get 80%. Wouldn't the world be wowed at that if we could get 80% response rates in our sample? People might hear that actually and think, why can't you get 100? Well, maybe we should aim for 100. But in order to have that, let's think about it for a second. You're going to need flexibility. It's like imagine you're a clinician and you're just seeing patients and you can treat them for as long as you want with as many dosing sessions as you want. And maybe you have even flexibility on drug. And so imagine a protocol that gave you that flexibility. And then maybe it would start to get possible, at least theoretically, that you could get something like complete reliability in treating your patients. Yeah, and it's, that would be a fun ambition and a very noble one, I think, to go after would be to give yourself a protocol, give your patients a protocol that allows you that kind of treatment freedom. So that's one idea. There are other ideas. Yeah. In terms of what data will we see next, we're doing an anorexia trial at Imperial. I think it's okay to still say we, given that I've formally moved to UCSF. But, you know, we're all close and colleagues and collaborators, really. Three patients are enrolled. One patient has been treated with all three dosages. So far, so good. Really excited about that. Meg Spriggs leading that one. The Nickian Foundation funding that. And, yeah, we've got a healthy volunteer study that shows fascinating changes in the brain that endure out at 1 month post-treatment. Super excited about that. Some really novel findings there. I think it's really important to do this research in healthy volunteers, given the direction of travel with psychedelic medicine and how it could quite realistically open up to a very broad population. So that's another part of the motivation. It's not just the translational value that you can look in healthies and it carries meaning for people with depression, but you know, psychedelic medicine can be useful and beneficial for many people, I think, at many times in their life.
Well, and I think all of our listeners would agree with you in that statement. And
We don't have much time left, but I always like to end this podcast offering my guests the opportunity to speak directly to psychedelic therapists and those who aspire to be. And so you've been toiling away with an incredible team, researching, trying to create the science or present the science that can help guide these therapists. And then in a sense, these therapists will be on the front lines of helping heal people. You've used psychedelic therapy in the context of psychedelics in the research that you've done, and it's clearly important to you. So I would love to just give you the opportunity to speak directly to those therapists and aspiring therapists who will be using these medicines to support the healing of so many people.
Well, in a sense, good on you guys, as trite as that sounds. It's a noble thing to be doing. Yeah, I said to a psychiatrist colleague of mine once in the office, it was just the two of us there, and I said, I looked him in the eyes and I said, it's blessed work, isn't it? You know, and he quietly nodded and smiled, and it feels that way. It's a privilege to do, and it's a wonderful thing, like a virtuous cycle when you enjoy it, you want to do it, and it can turn people's lives around for the better. It's a really special thing. So good on all of you. And also, just as there are dark nights for patients, there'll be dark nights for therapists, and there'll be challenges. The therapists will know this already, particularly if they're already clinicians, but all storms pass and so on. And it's a practice, you know. This is something else a colleague said to me, in the same way that meditation is a practice and you have spiritual practice, I think psychedelic medicine is a practice. And when seen in that way, when you relapse or a storm happens, you have that in the back of your mind that this is ongoing, the journey goes on, and the work, in a sense, the work never stops. And that's okay.
Here's to the work that never stops. And your work seems to never stop. I'm happy you'll be in my neck of the woods these days. Thank you so much for the work you do and for the diligence with which you approach this work. And I love what you were saying earlier about being careful about not attaching to the narratives. They're so common in this space in particular that we all want to see that beautiful story, but we need to see the data. And you keep providing this data and coming up with these incredible research studies. So we are all very indebted to you. And how can people follow you? How can people see new articles that are coming out that you're publishing? What's the best way people can track your work in these days?
Yeah, Twitter, whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, I do tweet and it's me doing it. And so they can follow me there. And I'm always sharing science stuff. My old man said to me once, keep politics out of it, Robin. Whenever he saw me say anything, you know, it's like, even if most of your followers are on side, don't bother. So anyway, yeah, I try and stick to the science, and I think probably people are, that's why they'd follow me anyway. So yeah.
Well, I'm already following you, and I'm sure our audience, if they are not, will start. Thank you so much for your time, Robin. Really appreciate you and your work.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to talk to you, Eamon.
Thank you for joining us on the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. If you enjoyed this show, please join the Psychedelic Therapy Facebook group to talk about it. You can also share it with your friends or leave a review on iTunes so more people can discover the show. The Psychedelic Therapy Podcast is presented by Maya, a platform designed to help psychedelic therapists manage and measure client journeys. You can head to mayahealth.com to learn more. The show is for informational purposes only and is not intended to provide mental health or medical advice. Thanks for listening.